I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thank you for joining us today for The American Idea. I'm Kara Rogers-Stevens, Associate Professor of History at Ashland University, and I am one of the hosts of The American Idea podcast. Today, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. John White, Professor of American Studies at Christopher Newport University. John is the author or the editor of 19 books and more than 100 articles, essays, and reviews about Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War, slavery and emancipation, and the American Constitution. He wrote an award-winning book with co-winning with John Meacham, A House Built by Slaves, African-American Visitors to the Lincoln White House in 2022. So did he co-author, or was this just they made you share the award with him?
We shared the award. He had his own, I had mine. Okay. I would love to co-author something with John at some point, though.
Yeah, great writer. But then bigger news, you've just recently edited a brand new book called A Great and Good Man, Rare Firsthand Accounts and Observations of Abraham Lincoln. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy of that. Are you having a good time talking about that book?
It is. The thing that makes that book a lot of fun is almost all of the accounts in it about Lincoln sold on eBay. And so these are letters and diaries that popped up for 7 days on eBay. Someone bought them. They went into a private collection, but the information was saved by my co-editor. So we're making it available to the public.
So did somebody, in other words, take photographs of all of the images of those documents before they disappeared? So you're actually able to read the text?
My co-editor, William Griffin, he goes by Griff, he retired from the chemical safety industry about 15 years ago, and he started going online searching eBay for Civil War letters for his collection, and he realized all this information is just disappearing and no longer available to scholars once it's been sold. Mm-hmm. So he reached out to a manuscript dealer and said, I've got a proposition for you. If you send me scans of the letters, I'll transcribe them. And the condition was that Griff could put the transcriptions on his own website, which he calls Spared and Shared, which is an incredible primary source resource for historians. And then the seller would take those transcriptions and put them on eBay, which would then lead to more bidding because there'd be more keyword searchable sort of things. And so I got introduced to Griff, I guess, about a year ago, and we ended up having a Zoom last May, and he said, well, I got a lot of stuff on Abraham Lincoln. And he sent it to me, and I said, Griff, you've got a book here. And so I pitched the idea to him, would you want to expand this into a book? And so we took all of these letters and diary excerpts that he had collected and did some annotation and editing and were able to turn it into A Great and Good Man. And so it's a really unique resource. I mean, I always tell people, eBay is a great place to do historical research because you can find things that are not available anywhere else. And so Griff and I now have been able to take some of that and compile a different kind of picture of Lincoln than people have had before.
Oh, that's incredible. So this is less letters written by Lincoln himself and more other people's observations and accounts of their time with him.
That's right. There have been a number of Lincoln letters that sold on eBay. We left those out and we just included accounts of people who either saw him or who were commenting on their views of what he was doing.
Ah, I have a Lincoln scholar whose birthday is coming up. That would be my husband is in a couple of days, has a big day coming. And maybe I need to get him this book, add it to his birthday pile. It sounds
It'd
fantastic.
Be a good gift.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're not here to discuss that book today, actually.
Right.
You're here to discuss another very timely issue, namely presidential pardons. So just this morning, Friday, January the 17th, the outgoing president, Joe Biden, commuted the sentences of 2,500 people, and he announced Quote, with this action, I have now issued more individual pardons and commutations than any president in U.S. history. So a momentous occasion. Yeah. And these sentences being commuted are in addition to December the 23rd, Biden commuted the sentences of 37 out of the 40 federal prisoners who were on death row. So those 37 will now serve life in prison without parole. And then back on December the 12th, there was also Biden commuted the sentences of 1,500 prisoners and pardoned an additional 39 people in what the White House called the largest act of clemency in a single day in modern presidential history. Now, he's not the first person to issue pardons, of course, and he's not even the first to issue many pardons. FDR pardoned 2,819. Jimmy Carter pardoned 534. And if we go back a bit further in American history, Abraham Lincoln is well known for showing mercy to many of those who petitioned him for pardons. And this will stay in the news because, of course, President-elect Trump has also said that he's going to be dealing with pardons even as he comes into office. So, John, maybe we can start our conversation today about presidential pardons by discussing the origins of this here in American constitutional thought. Is it true that this is actually a remnant of the old world, a power that is associated or was associated with the King of England that the Founding Fathers actually chose to hold over in the Constitution?
Yeah, I think the pardon power is the closest thing to a sort of regal power that an American president has. The president can do it without needing the advice and consent of the Senate, like the president needs to appoint people to certain federal offices. There's no need among the president for anyone's support in doing it. The president can choose at his will who he wants to pardon or grant clemency to. And there's different sort of levels of, you know, a full pardon sort of wipes the slate clean, whereas a commutation doesn't wipe the slate clean, but it says, you know, you no longer have to serve out your punishment. And so the president has that authority, and there's nothing anyone else can do about it. So I think it's the closest thing you can get to a kingly type power.
Huh. Are there any limits on who the president can pardon?
There are, in this sense. The president can only pardon federal crimes. So if someone is found guilty in a state court, the president has no authority over that. That falls to the governor or a state-appointed body, depending on what the state's policies and laws are. The president used to pardon people who were committed of committing crimes in the District of Columbia. So in the 19th century, Lincoln handled a lot of crimes that came out of Washington, D.C., because Congress legislated for D.C., and so those crimes then came to him when convicts wanted pardon. But those are generally the limitations. Any federal crime, any crime committed within the military, the president has the authority to pardon or commute the sentence.
And what about impeachments? He's not allowed to pardon impeachment. Is that
the one
exception?
That's true. He cannot pardon impeachments because those are dealt with in a different way, not through the civil courts, but through the House and the Senate.
Okay. All right. But otherwise, this sounds like the broadest power that the Constitution gives to the president, that he's able to exercise so much latitude without getting approval from any of the other branches of government.
Right. And that's not to say that presidents don't seek advice from people. And in fact, you know, there are whole offices now in the Department of Justice. And before the Department of Justice, there was a office of the pardon clerk who reported directly to the attorney general, who would review cases and then make advice to the president. But the president didn't have to take their advice. And the president could either choose to do what he wanted or to follow their advice.
So why did the founders decide to keep this kingly power in the American system? Why does the Constitution give the president so much latitude? What's the point?
It's a great question. And I think a lot of what we know about it comes from Federalist 74, where Hamilton talks about giving this power. And I think for Hamilton in Fed 74, there was a very specific reason he had in mind. And keep in mind that they're writing the Constitution in the aftermath of Shays' rebellion. And so they're thinking about upheaval and insurgency and insurrection in the country. And so one of the ideas that the Federalists had was granting this power to the president can actually be a useful way to try to quell insurgency, so that if you have an uprising in a part of the country, the president can act quickly and essentially say, you know, if you turn from your wicked ways, I'll grant pardon, and that might persuade people to stop an uprising. And so Hamilton talks about that in Federalist 74. And whereas if you put it with the legislature, or if the president needed legislative approval, you know, that can take weeks, months, or years, or maybe never happen. It's really hard to get a bunch of people into a room and get them to agree on everything. So from Hamilton's perspective in Fed 74, it was really important to give it to one person who could act quickly in a moment where quick action was needed.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it's not so much about giving the president a power that makes him feel powerful or that allows him to maybe make decisions that might help his own political career. It was initially conceived of as a way to help reunify the nation, help control domestic insurrection. That's fascinating. And had that been something that was used after Shays' rebellion?
Yeah, so actually some of the in Shays' rebellion, gosh, that's going to take me way back. So, yes, there was some pardoning in Massachusetts after Shays' rebellion, although my recollection is, don't quote me on this, but I don't recall if the governor exercised that power exclusively or if the legislature was somehow involved in Massachusetts. I don't recall. I know there were a number of people who were arrested after Shays' rebellion and that clemency was used in a number of cases. Yeah. But then George Washington uses it in this way in the 1790s. So in 1794, you've got the Whiskey Rebellion in western Pennsylvania, where, you know, there's no cash in the frontier of Pennsylvania, and people out there often barter and trade with whiskey. And when Hamilton's fiscal policies went into effect in the early 1790s, that started to require people in the frontier to keep records and pay taxes in money that they just didn't have, there was this uprising to try to shut down the law, the execution of the law. Right. And George Washington sends an army out and it suppresses the rebellion. And several of the men who were involved are brought to Philadelphia for trial and they're found guilty of treason and sentenced to be executed. And in those cases, George Washington used the pardon power to show mercy and I think try to extend this olive branch to people on the frontier who were really upset about what elite leaders in the Eastern Seaboard were doing to them. Same thing happened a couple years later under John Adams. Again, there were insurrections over taxes involved in Pennsylvania. This time they were near Philadelphia. And in the midst of those, John Adams showed mercy and pardoned the leader of that so-called rebellion. His name was John Freeze. And I think, again, John Adams was trying to show, you know, this is a government that's trying to bring the people in. And yes, they were upset about what was going on. And John Freeze was pardoned or was sentenced to be executed. But Adams wanted to show mercy and show clemency, I think, to try to bring sort of harmony back to that part of the country. Incidentally, Alexander Hamilton was furious that John Adams did that. So it's a little irony there. But yeah, very early in our history, the pardon power is used in those notable ways between Washington and Adams to try to bring peace back when there was some insurrection.
So it sounds like these early presidents are using the pardon sparingly in these specific moments of tension, upheaval, in order to show clemency and maybe try to reunite the nation, calm some tempers. How has the use of the pardon changed over time? So, if, for instance, between George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, how do we see the pardon being used? Was it in similar circumstances only, or did it become more and more common for presidents to issue these different pardons?
Presidents would use that power for different things. I mean, today, I think a lot of times it's used in political ways. So you've got to be politically connected, or if you're famous, you might get a pardon. That's probably an outgrowth of the 20th century and into the 21st century. in the 19th century, you do have some of this where people will write to a president and say, you know, I was accused of this crime, I was convicted, will you pardon me? And it might be a nobody. But what would often happen is that nobody would be connected to someone who had some authority who would also write on their behalf. So it's not at all uncommon to look at pardon case files at the National Archives from convicts who we would never know of today, but there might be letters from members of Congress in there, or from senators, or from governors. And often those would carry a lot of weight. And so the president might not be acting. I mean, sometimes the president might be motivated by politics. Well, like, oh, I need to keep this member of Congress on my side, so I'll pardon the person they're asking me to. But in some cases, it might just be that the fact that a member of Congress wrote brought a case to the attention of the president, who then led the president to act. One of the more notorious instances, and this goes back to Jefferson, you know, Jefferson hated Aaron Burr because of the way Aaron Burr tried to steal the presidential election of 1800 from him. And Jefferson knew that he couldn't trust Burr. And of course, when Jefferson ran for re-election, he did not run with Burr as his running mate. Well, in 1807, Jefferson goes after Burr for treason. Mm-hmm. And it had to do with these sort of excursions that Burr was doing to try to maybe capture Mexico or turn part of the United States over to Spain. We don't know exactly what.
Maybe raise an army and invade from the south and the west. Yeah.
And so when Burr finally got arrested and taken to Richmond for trial, one of the things that Jefferson did was he sent blank pardons down to the trial and basically authorized his U.S. attorney and I think attorney general, anyone who's willing to turn coat and testify against Burr, give them a pardon. So wow. Jefferson was willing to use them in that way to try to go after a political enemy.
I guess that indicates how great of a threat Jefferson believed Burr to be. And maybe also how difficult it was to try to get Burr convicted. Treason is a very difficult charge to prove, isn't it? So
getting
Burr convicted on treason was, in the end, impossible. But that shows how much Jefferson was worried about Burr escaping back and maybe causing more mischief in the future.
Yeah, well, I personally think a lot of it was personal. I mean, I think it went back to the election of 1800. I think Jefferson was more concerned about that, what Burr had done or tried to do to him in terms of stealing the presidency. And for those who don't know, in that day, in that time, when the Electoral College voted, they didn't differentiate your voting for president versus vice president. The Electoral College just voted, and whoever got first got presidency, whoever got second got vice president. And since Jefferson and Burr ran together, they got the same number of votes. And everyone knew that the Electoral College intended for Jefferson to be president, but because they got the same number of votes and Burr didn't back out, it got thrown into the House of Representatives. And I think it took 37 ballots for the election to be decided. And that just turned Jefferson against Burr.
But even Hamilton was against Burr at that point, wasn't he? Didn't Hamilton throw his hat in the ring and say, actually, hey, Federalists, maybe we need to vote for Jefferson because Jefferson, we don't like his principles, but at least he has them.
I think Hamilton let it go on. It went about 37 ballots, and Hamilton allowed that to happen before he finally did tell the Federalists in Congress, support Jefferson and bring this to a close.
It's so fascinating how the personal relationships between these famous figures influences their actions on the national stage.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, are there times in American history where issuing pardons has actually backfired for a president? I'm thinking in particular about Gerald Ford, who pardoned his predecessor, Richard Nixon, and arguably this made Ford less popular and he lost his next election to Jimmy Carter.
I think that's true. And not to get too much into the contemporary issues, but I think that Biden's pardon of his son and some of these other ones, his approval rating has dropped a lot in the last couple of weeks. And I think that those pardons have probably hurt his legacy in that way. So, yeah, I mean, most of the time, Americans don't pay a whole lot of attention to pardons. But there are the Nixon one is a really big one. There are some of these cases where they really do capture the national imagination or national attention because of the players involved.
Do you think that that's part of the reason why the White House is emphasizing that Biden has now issued more pardons and commutations than anybody else? Is that an attempt to distract from the controversy around Hunter Biden's pardon?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's sort of a way of trying to say this is part of Biden's legacy. Now,
Right.
my recollection is because of the way Jimmy Carter handled protesters in the Vietnam War, Carter may have more, but they were not sort of individualized pardons in the way that Biden is specifically naming the people who are receiving clemency in these cases. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a historic legacy for a president to be able to say, I've done more than anyone else in this arena. So I have a feeling that's a big part of it.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about Lincoln and his use of the presidential pardon. So Abraham Lincoln, as you mentioned, is president during a time when he's getting pardon requests from criminals within the District of Columbia, but he's also president, of course, famously during the Civil War. And so he's dealing with all of these military convictions, desertions. I believe one of his first requests was because of a soldier who had fallen asleep at his post. Can you tell us about the context in which Lincoln was asked to pardon and commute sentences? What was unique to the Lincoln situation?
Yeah, for Lincoln, he's dealing with not only federal crimes and crimes in DC, but then also military crimes, which every president has to deal with, although there are a lot more in his presidency than in the typical 19th century presidency. And then the other one that Lincoln has to deal with are Confederates who want to come back into the Union and restore their citizenship rights. And so throughout the war, at different points in December of 1863 and March of 1864, Lincoln issues proclamations that lay out the terms for by which Confederates can come back into their rights as citizens. They have to, take an oath of prospective loyalty. So Lincoln never wants people to have to swear, "I've never been disloyal." He says he believes in the Christian doctrine of forgiveness, and so swear that you'll be loyal from here on out. And then that they would also abide by the laws of Congress and the acts of the president, which was essentially saying you've got to renounce slavery. And so if you take an oath of loyalty that you will be loyal to the Union moving forward and renounce slavery, you can come back into the Union as a citizen. And so Lincoln is dealing with those as well, and then Johnson deals with those as well. So that's sort of a unique thing about the 19th century or the mid-19th century that Lincoln and Johnson deal with that no other president really has to deal with.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, Chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country, and they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So, if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Do we know how many, so when Lincoln was pardoning Confederates, do we know how many people were involved, or was he offering kind of amnesty to entire groups of people at that point in the war?
So he lays his proclamation is actually called a proclamation of amnesty and reconstruction. So he uses that word, and he lays out different groups of Confederates who can receive this if they abide by the terms, and then he excludes some more high-ranking Confederates who are not able to receive amnesty. But they each still have to write to him individually. And so at the Library of Congress, there are thousands of documents written by Confederates or relatives of Confederates. A lot of them are,
Wow.
wives and mothers. My son or my husband is a Confederate and he was captured in the battlefield and he's now at Camp Chase in Ohio. I want to get him released. So there are thousands and thousands of letters like that that came in during Lincoln's administration and then Johnson's. And there was a bit of the federal bureaucracy within the War Department that then had to sift through and deal with those.
My goodness. So Lincoln wasn't individually reading and responding to every single one of those requests, surely.
No, he couldn't. And yeah. David Herbert Donald, who was a very famous Lincoln biographer at Harvard for many years, he estimated that Lincoln received between 200 and 300 pieces of correspondence every day. So it kind of feels like my inbox in my university email system. You know, we get all these emails. And for us, it's very easy to just like click through and delete or ignore the things that we don't need to handle. Lincoln, there was no way he could have handled all of that correspondence. And that's correspondence for everything, not just pardons. But right. There's no way he could have handled all of that correspondence and managed all of federal patronage and the war effort and everything else. So he had secretaries who worked in his office, and he only had about three at a time, but he had these secretaries who would get this incoming correspondence, and then they would generally refer it to the appropriate agency or department of the government. And so when you go to the National Archives and you look through these documents, you can see the docketing on the back where it'll say, you know, referred by the president to the judge advocate general or to the attorney general or to the secretary of state. And then it would go from there to someone else. And eventually it might make its way back to Lincoln, depending on the case. And so most of the correspondence he saw or he received, he never saw, because he just couldn't, there wasn't enough time for him to do that.
No, of course. So when the White House tells us that Biden is now responsible for the highest number of pardons and commutations for an American president, is that accurate given what we know about Lincoln and all of these different requests that he received? Or is it accurate because of the way that we classify these different requests?
I think it's accurate in part because of the way we classify the requests, because, again, I think Jimmy Carter would technically have more if you include the post-Vietnam commutation. I don't recall the word they used to describe the Carter year ones, but but in terms of actual pardons and commutations, I do think Biden is correct in that. I don't know the number of Confederates who received amnesty under Lincoln. The vast majority of Confederates receive it under Andrew Johnson. That comes after Lincoln's assassinated, I should say.
Right, yeah. Well, what about Lincoln getting requests from individual soldiers for these different pardons when he was president? Is there a pattern to the requests that he would grant versus the ones that he would turn down?
Yeah, Lincoln had a very keen sense of justice, and so he would make his decisions based on what he believed justice required, or had someone served enough of a punishment to satisfy what justice required for the crime they had committed. And so in cases involving women, where women were the victims, Lincoln almost always allowed, not always, but almost always allowed the criminal to face the full penalty of the law. So in cases involving rape and sexual assault, Lincoln had, I think, a very keen sense of justice in those cases, and he wanted the convict to receive the full punishment. He very rarely, in some cases he did, but very rarely showed clemency in those kind of cases.
Wow.
Contrast that with sleeping sentinels. So you asked about one very early in his administration. Lincoln received a little over 90 pardon requests involving sleeping sentinels who fell asleep at their post. Mm-hmm. In all 90 cases, he showed mercy.
Wow.
And I think Lincoln's view there was, these guys are not professional soldiers. These are farm boys and store clerks. They've joined the army. They're fighting for the cause. They don't fully recognize the gravity of the situation in every case, or in some cases, they're just plain tired. So William Scott, the one you asked about before, he was a 23-year-old soldier from Vermont. He is stationed outside of Georgetown in Washington, D.C. And a friend of his has guard duty one night and is sick, and so William Scott agrees to take it for him. The next night is William Scott's own night to take guard duty. And so he's been up the night before, and now he's to be up the next night. And he's in this little area where he's on guard with two other men. And under the army regulations, all three men are supposed to stay awake together. But it's early in the war. This is August, September 1861. Again, the war is just getting started. And so these guys are still very green as soldiers, and they make this deal with each other. Hey, you know, I'll stay awake for this part of the night, and then you stay awake for the next part, and then you stay awake for the next part, and we'll take turns, and that way we can get some shut-eye. And so during William Scott's time to be awake, he falls asleep, because again, he's been up the night before, and he's very tired. And an officer comes by and sees these three men asleep and wakes them up. Now, all three of them should have gotten punished because they were all supposed to be awake, but the officer knew these sort of deals that the guys made. And so the officer says, whose turn was it to be awake? And the two guys point at William Scott and say it was his turn. And so Scott gets court-martialed and sentenced to be executed. And word gets back to Lincoln.
Interrupt you there for a second. Why was the punishment so harsh for the crime of falling asleep?
So from the military perspective, and they're exactly right about this, the only way that an army camp can get rest at night is if the soldiers can sleep knowing that the guards are awake. And so the military brass, they want people like William Scott to be executed because they know that's the only way to let the army rest at night. So it's a very serious crime.
And my goodness.
And people like George McClellan and other generals, actually, you know, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, writes about this. William T. Sherman, they write about it. They believe that these soldiers should be executed because you've got to set an example to other soldiers. If you fall asleep at your post, this is what's going to happen to you. And executions in the military were very public. The execution would take place in front of about 1,000 men. The condemned man would be put to sit on his coffin. 11 guys would line up to be the firing squad. 12 would line up to be the firing squad. 11 would have bullets. One would not. And that way, none of them would know for sure that he had fired the gun that killed the condemned man.
Wow.
If all went well, the condemned man would fall backwards, get shot, fall backwards into his coffin, and then those 1,000 men who had watched this would be made to march past the open coffin, look down, and that would be the lesson to them. You don't want this to happen to you. Don't fall asleep at your post.
Wow.
And so Scott gets sentenced to be executed, and according to the stories that come down to us, they were all lined up, ready for the execution to take place. According to some accounts, some of his brothers were detailed among the executioners.
That
at the last minute, the pardon comes in from Lincoln. And Lincoln says it's not a precedent for other cases, but because the war is new and Scott is young, he'll show mercy in this case. Ultimately, Lincoln does allow that to be a precedent in other cases, and he never, as far as I know, he never executes someone for falling asleep at their post.
Wow. So long as the petition reached him in time, I'm assuming. So were some people executed who didn't have a chance to speak to the president?
There were a few cases for not the entirety of the war, but for much of the war, the military was not allowed to carry out an execution without Lincoln's approval.
Okay.
And so executions were often delayed until Lincoln signed off on it.
My goodness. I've actually, the one place that I've come across this in my own classes and research is in the journey of Lewis and Clark. So they're leading a military expedition on this massive adventure across the unknown Western frontier. And early in the expedition, there are a couple of people who are court-martialed for falling asleep. And the punishments in those cases were whippings.
Oh,
and
well.
My students are always a little shocked. But there were also some Native American observers who were rather shocked by some of the military discipline that was issued by Lewis and Clark toward their soldiers. And interestingly, one of the Native people says, Native chief says, his tribe never used any form of corporal punishment, but he did execute people who disobeyed his authority and caused problems. So even there was a cultural issue with corporal punishment being unacceptable, but the necessity of setting an example seems to be something that is across borders, across cultures.
I think whipping was outlawed from the U.S. Army a year or so before the Civil War. One of the most powerful scenes in the movie Glory is when Denzel Washington's character gets whipped. And yet that's one of the fictionalized scenes because whipping had been outlawed by then. But yeah, in the earlier 19th century, and especially on ships, that would have been a common thing.
My goodness. Well, one of the other really interesting stories that you talk about in you've written an essay recently about Abraham Lincoln and the pardon power over at realclearhistory.com. One of the other interesting stories that you actually spoke about was one dealing with Native Americans, and it was one I hadn't heard of, something to do with the Dakota people and an uprising. Can you tell us the story of Lincoln and his involvement in pardoning Native Americans?
Yeah, this is one of the most controversial aspects of Lincoln's presidency. So the Dakota people had signed treaties with the United States in the 1850s, a couple in 1851 and 1858, that ceded much of their land to the U.S. And then white settlers began moving out and taking over this land. And the Dakotas were then kind of hemmed in on two reservations along the Minnesota River. And in exchange for ceding their land, the federal government was supposed to be sending gold annuities to the Dakotas every year. But with the war going on, these annuities were coming in late. And not only that, Indian agents were highly corrupt, and merchants and traders would bilk the Indians and overcharge them for things. And so by the time the annuities would come in year after year, the Indians were so far in debt that they owed all of the money they were receiving to these whites who had settled in Minnesota. And by August of 1862, the Dakota are starving, the annuities are late, and four Dakota men happen upon a house of a white family. And one of them picks up some eggs and goes to eat the eggs. And another one says, "Don't do that. They belong to a white man." And the guy with the eggs gets really angry and he throws them to the ground. And he says, "You're afraid of the white man." And the other guy says, "No, I'm not. And to prove that I'm not, I'll go into the house and shoot him. And then will you come with me?" And the other guy says, "Yes." And then their two other companions say, "You know, to prove we're brave, we'll come with you too." And these four men go into the house and they kill this white family and go back to their village and tell what they've done. And the young Dakota warriors decide they want to go to war. And it sets off this 6-week war between the Dakotas, who were led by a chief named Little Crow, and the white Minnesotans. And in the process, the Dakotas kill probably about 650 people, white people. They take a lot of captives. Stories of rape were very common. Stories of shooting and killing unarmed white civilians were very common. And they circulate widely in the press. And after about 6 weeks, the U.S. Army is able to suppress this insurrection, and they arrest, I think, about 1,500 Dakotas, and some of them escape westward into the Dakota Territory. And the Army very quickly sets up a military commission and tries hundreds and hundreds of these guys in a military court. And 303 are found guilty and sentenced to be executed. And the thing about these trials is some of them were as short as 10 minutes. In a number of cases, the Dakotas didn't speak English and didn't know what they were being charged with. They didn't have legal representation. And so they're just sentenced to be executed. And the people of Minnesota want these executions to take place quickly. Mm-hmm. And members of Congress are giving speeches about how the executions need to take place. People are writing to Lincoln saying, "You got to do this." Journalists are saying, "Execute them, kill them now." And Lincoln deliberately slows things down, and he sends a message to Minnesota saying, "Do not execute anyone until you've heard from me." He then gets three lawyers that he trusts, and he has them go through all 303 case files. And what Lincoln wants them to figure out is who has committed what we would call a war crime or an atrocity, and who was picked up on the battlefield like a soldier in arms. And Lincoln wants to figure out, the guys who were picked up as soldiers should be treated as soldiers. People who have violated women or shot and killed unarmed civilians, they should be treated as war criminals. And in the end, Lincoln determines that 38 of them should be executed and the rest should not. And ultimately, the 38 are executed. What's controversial about this, I mean, there's a whole lot that's controversial
sure.
about it, but this is the largest single-day mass execution in American history. 38 men taken to a single set-up gallows, executed at once. On the other hand, it's also the largest single-day mass commutation in American history. And it was Lincoln trying to figure out what justice required. And I mentioned a little bit ago when you asked about, you know, how did Lincoln make decisions? Well, for him, it had to do with what did justice require. And so Lincoln allowed white defendants who had raped women or white guerrillas who killed unarmed civilians, he allowed them to face the full punishment of the law in the same way that he did with the Native Americans in this
case.
So I really believe that Lincoln made his decisions based on what he thought justice required, and he didn't treat the Native people different than he would have treated white people in that case. Now, the big difference, of course, is that there's no case where 38 white people are executed at once. So I recognize the complexities of this, but I think a lot of times people talk about this is the largest execution without including it's the largest commutation. And what's really telling is that in 1864, a politician comes and meets with Lincoln and says, essentially, you know, the Republicans could have done a lot better in Minnesota in the last election if you'd hanged all of them. And Lincoln turns to him and says, I could not afford to hang men for votes. And that speaks volumes of Lincoln's character, that he wasn't going to just do what was going to be politically popular. He was going to do what he believed was right.
My goodness, the choices that Lincoln had to deal with during his presidency are mind-boggling. We think that the modern presidency is complicated and the decisions that our modern presidents have to make are difficult, and I'm sure they are. But the moral complexity of the decisions that Lincoln had to deal with regularly are really remarkable. So that's fascinating to learn about. And the one last thing that I did want to ask you about today was Lincoln and the issue of pardoning slave traders. So many in our audience will probably recall that trading slaves, at least internationally, had been illegal. The Congress banned that starting in 1807. And Thomas Jefferson signed the paperwork and was very happy that we had ended our involvement in the slave trade. But there were still people who got on ships and found slaves and were trading them internationally. And many of those people got away with it or were not punished according to the full force of the law. What was Lincoln's attitude when such situations arose under his presidency?
Yeah, so the slave trade, Jefferson signs the bill in 1807, but the slave trade continues. So in 1820, Congress makes it so that slave trading internationally is piracy, meaning you can be executed for it. But then for the next 40 years, no one is ever punished for the crime in any meaningful way. Slave traders often bribe jailers or U.S. marshals or jurors so that they can get out of facing punishment. But Lincoln, very early in his administration, decides that he is going to end this infernal traffic. And so he calls his cabinet together in May of 1861, tells his Secretary of the Interior and Attorney General and Secretary of State that they're going to be responsible to do this. And he very quickly does everything he can to kill the slave trade. And the most famous instance of Lincoln doing this involves a slave trader named Nathaniel Gordon. Gordon was captured on the west coast of Africa with 897 Africans on board his ship. He was clearly guilty. That was not his first slave trading voyage. I think he had done four voyages at least in the 1850s. Wow. He gets brought to New York City under Buchanan's administration. And Buchanan's U.S. Marshal allows Nathaniel Gordon to leave jail for a $50 bribe and have fancy dinners in Manhattan. So Gordon thinks he has nothing to fear. His first trial ends in a mistrial because they didn't sequester the jury, so jurors were almost certainly bribed. But then after Lincoln takes over and puts in a new U.S. attorney and a new U.S. marshal, they put Gordon into what we would today consider a maximum security prison. It was known as the Tombs. They try him again. This time they sequester the jury, and he is found guilty and sentenced to be executed. And as crazy as it might be for us to believe, thousands of Northerners signed petitions asking Lincoln to show mercy. And Lincoln refused. And he ended up giving Gordon a 2-week stay of execution. In Lincoln's words, and this is sort of Lincoln's gallows humor, he says, so that Gordon may make the necessary preparation for the awful change which awaits him. In other words, Gordon never thought he'd get punished. He didn't see it coming. I'll give him 2 extra weeks to think about it. Wow. And I've written about this in a book called Shipwrecked, where I write about another slave trader. I've actually written about all these pardons in different books I've done on Lincoln. And part of the stay of execution, Lincoln said this: in granting this respite, it becomes my painful duty to admonish the prisoner that, relinquishing all expectation of pardon by human authority, he refer himself alone to the mercy of the common God and Father of all men. Wow. Now, that is an incredible statement for Lincoln to make, because the law of the land in 1862, when Lincoln issues that statement, was the Dred Scott decision of 1857, where Roger Taney said that Africans and their descendants in America were nothing but, in Taney's words, articles of merchandise to be bought and sold whenever a profit could be made. Mm-hmm. So from the Supreme Court's perspective, Africans and African Americans are subhuman, they're property, they're something to be traded and profited from. Lincoln is saying to Nathaniel Gordon here, these are human beings made in the image of God who deserve dignity and respect, and you better get right with that before you meet your maker. And Gordon tried to cheat the gallows. A friend snuck poison in the night before the execution was scheduled to take place. Cracked open the cigar, took the poison. In the middle of the night, the jailers heard him writhing in pain. They rush in. They see what was going on. They summon a doctor. They pump his stomach. He vomits it out. And they keep him alive so that the very next day at noon, February 21st, 1862, he'll go to the gallows. And I think it was really important to Lincoln to make sure that that happened. Now, I won't lie to you. In the book, I give a much broader context of what Lincoln does, and there are some cases where Lincoln does pardon or commute the sentences of slave traders because he believed extenuating circumstances required it. So it's not that Lincoln executed every slave trader, but in this case where Gordon was so clearly guilty, Lincoln wanted the world to know, I will not show mercy to someone who commits a crime like this.
Wow. And the way that he spoke about it, especially, I love that quote, referring to God as the common father of all. That's a wonderful lesson that seems Lincoln was attempting to emphasize, that the principles of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal and have natural rights because of that equal creation. Lincoln was going to insist on the truth of that here in this new version of America that he was fighting for in the Civil War.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, what an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing about that and all of these other information that you've given us today about presidential pardons. If anybody would like to read this essay, and I would highly recommend it, your essay about Lincoln and the pardon power, you can head over to realclearhistory.com, and we'll post a link to the exact article here in our show notes. And then, of course, we also highly recommend John's new book, A Great and Good Man, Rare Firsthand Accounts and Observations of Abraham Lincoln, not just locked away in some person's safe, now actually available for people to read. Thank you for doing that good work of making those eBay documents available to the rest of us. And thank you so much for coming and joining me again today on The American Idea.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.